Well, hey everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. Thanks so much, especially a lot of you really have been listening and listening regularly. I think you know we're obviously on every Tuesday at 4 o'clock on the Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 98.7 FM. 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the web at kpfk.org. Today we're going to discuss the Supreme Court's recent decision to vacate critical sections of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Joining me in the first segment of the show from Washington, D.C. is Barbara Arnwine, the President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law. In the second segment, I'm going to continue discussing on the Voting Rights Act with Brenton Mock, a New Orleans-based journalist who serves as Colorline Magazine's reporting fellow on voting rights. So hey everybody, we're going to be talking with Barbara Arnwine, the President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law, and she's been working there since 1989, the same time that we started the Labor Community Strategy Center. Barb is known for her work on the passage of the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1991 and the creation of the 2011 Voting Rights Map of Shame. How are you doing, Barbara?
It's great to be talking with you today, Eric. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. I wish it was under better circumstances, but this seems, this seems to be our life right now is trying to fight the counter-revolution. For our listeners, I mean, Barbara's going to go into it in more detail, but just so you know, I know a little bit, is that under the Voting Rights Act, one of the things that happened is that certain states and regions were singled out in the good sense because of their very, very bad history of denying voting rights. And they had to essentially send any voting rights plans to the Justice Department to be reviewed before they could be implemented. Section 5 gave the right of the Justice Department to review it generally. What's happened is that the court claims that basically that discrimination and voting rights suppression is pretty much over, or at least arguing that the states of Texas, Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and parts of Florida, as well as, Barbara, I learned, parts of New York, Alaska, New Hampshire, and California, that had previously been required to submit any changes in the voting rights laws are now exempted, and there are no longer any groups, any states that have to submit anything, which means, in their mind, that they're free to begin to more aggressively violate the Voting Rights Act of people in their region. Is that accurate? And before we get into what to do, obviously, correct any mistakes, and then please amplify on the actual law and a little bit about your understanding of how this decision came down.
Well, a number of things. First of all, everyone should know that there's been no more powerful civil rights law than the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And this was an act that came out of protests, bloodshed, and indeed martyrdom, where, you know, people like Medgar Evers was killed, 50 years ago. And the fight for voting rights. It's no accident that Medgar Evers was shot as he came home from a voter registration rally. So it's very important for people to understand, you know, how important this act has been, because it has literally led to the election of thousands of African American, Latino, Asian American, and Native American elected officials. What has happened is that the Voting Rights Act has several provisions, and two of its most powerful provisions were what we call Section 5 and Section 4. Section 5 is the requirement that states with a history of racial discrimination in voting, and jurisdictions, I should say, because counties and cities are also covered, and indeed in New York, boroughs are covered, were covered by the act, and it requires that these jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination in voting have to pre-clear, get a permission from either a federal court or the Department of Justice that the proposed election law, practice, or procedure will not have a racially discriminatory impact or effect. So that has been, as I call it, the great stop sign. It basically tells jurisdictions, stop, before you act. You cannot, implement any procedure until we make sure it's not racially discriminatory. Well, what has happened is that Section 4 of the Act told which jurisdictions that they were covered by Section 5. So they would tell the Section 4 was the coverage formula that said that the state of Texas was covered, that said that the state of Virginia was covered, that said that five counties in Florida were covered, that said that, counties in California were covered, that said that, various Mississippi and Alabama and other states were covered because of their nefarious and notorious history of discrimination in voting. What the court did a week ago was that the court decided that they were going to create a new set of legal standards and basically ignored the whole 15th Amendment and its conference upon Congress of the responsibility for determining if states should be covered, if states, are to stop discrimination in voting and to implement any law that they thought was necessary to prevent discrimination in voting. And what happened was, of course, Congress had enacted the 1965 Act with Section 4 and 5, and interestingly, the courts had challenges to Section 5 and Section 4 no less than five or six times, where the court actually ruled each time in Congress's favor that these were necessary and important laws. Well, in 2006, the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized again, because Section 5 and Section 4, because they're race-conscious measures, have to be time-limited under our constitutional principles. So when the court heard the challenge to this statute, and had heard a challenge initially a few...
You're listening to Barbara Arnwine, by the way, from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law in Washington. Barbara, just get to right to that one, because I want to ask you a question back. So you're now in the last challenge to the law. Go ahead.
Yes, and so in 2006, as soon as Congress passed the law, right-wing forces brought a lawsuit representing a utility district out of Texas, brought a challenge to the law saying it was unconstitutional within 8 days after its passage. And they were not able to prevail because the court said, well, if you got a good record, you can bail out. So Shelby County, Alabama decided that it would bring a challenge to the law after that lawsuit and basically said, we can't bail out because we have discriminated in 2002 and we discriminated in 2008 in voting. So we can't bail out, and it's not fair that this law, applies to us and to jurisdictions with clean hands. The most bizarre argument I've ever heard.
Now, Barbara, let me come in here. I think that's an excellent background. Let me tell you what my concern is, that you've spent your whole life working with the law, and obviously lawyers, in your case, being a really great, great civil rights lawyer, really, and black lawyers in particular, have taken the law, especially the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, as a sort of Bible, as the anti-slavery amendments. But what do we do when a John Roberts court knows beforehand that it doesn't matter what you say, they have five votes, and they decided in a predetermined action to overturn the Voting Rights Act.
Overturn Section 4,
All right, to overturn Section 4. So if you knew that, what does it make you say to law students and to people that so-called, believe in the law, when in fact it's whoever has the power changes the law?
Well, obviously when they invalidated Section 4 last week and said that the coverage formula no longer applied because it was unfair to, to the states, that there wasn't what they called it did not accord equal sovereignty to the states, and that there wasn't a recognition in 2006 of, quote, current conditions. The court, just basically did what I call an ideological rush to judgment, because basically what they did was they continued this ugly trend that the court has been doing now for quite a while of elevating states' rights above the rights of citizens, and saying basically it's more important for states to have the right to operate if they want to, free and unfettered by, you know, laws and requirements that they not discriminate, than to prevent discrimination against citizens. That is a horrible balancing act that they've done. And even if you know, I know a lot of people have been celebrating the DOMA decisions, but do understand that those decisions are states' rights decisions, again, that they're based upon the same kind of, you know, states' rights doctrine. It just, in one instance, it, you know, was devastating on race, and in the other instance, you know, struck down a law that was unfair on the basis of, you know, sexual orientation.
Well, let me ask you this again, that this is important, that obviously the outrage that we both feel is almost unbelievable. The question, again, I want to come to is, I just want to talk a little bit as an organizer about remedy and about, no, seriously, about things I've been thinking about. I want you to respond to it. And for people that know Barbara, mm-hmm. she is a lawyer slash organizer or an organizer slash lawyer. I mean, she's a movement person. She's a movement person first, and the particular role she plays is a wonderful attorney for the people. By the way, Barbara and Lawyers Committee have been the absolutely biggest allies of the environmental justice movement. They've challenged,
yes,
they've challenged the EPA, even Lisa yes. Jackson. They pushed Lisa Jackson to enforce Title VI more. And so yes. this is a fighting group we're talking to. Let me tell you what my concern is. In both the Sandoval case, which took away the right yes. of so-called private parties to sue, and now this case, the Supreme Court very cleverly is saying, I want to send it back to Congress. In both cases, mm-hmm. we know that Congress, under the present set of political conditions, is never going to vote to reestablish that 9 to 10 states and all these other are habitual racist lawbreakers. So here's my question. I've been arguing all along that President Obama has enormous power under Title VI to withhold federal funds from any institution in the United States that receives federal money that uses them in a racially discriminatory manner, and the president is not doing that, and the Justice Department is not enforcing that. So tactic one is that, you know, if, of course, the president of the United States was Frederick Douglass, they would go in and say, all right, I'll tell you what, anybody who moves your Voting Rights Act an inch, I'm going to come in and investigate every hospital, every school board, every nursing home. I'm going to pull federal funds out of everything. That's one thing I know he could do. But the second question is, what power does the president have now? Now that the Section 4 is being thrown back to Congress, what's the most aggressive things that a Justice Department could do? The most aggressive thing the President of the United States could do within the new constraints of the law?
I think a couple things. One is that they absolutely must, you know, focus on monitoring all of these previously covered jurisdictions. Now, listen to me, people. The challenge is that there were 12,000 previously covered jurisdictions, and we need your help in monitoring them, because the Justice Department doesn't even have, you know, 12,000 people, you know, accorded to this area of practice. So we need the people of this country to monitor your local jurisdictions, and if you see a racially discriminatory law, you need to report it. And you can call us to report any racially discriminatory law at 1-866-OUR-VOTE. That's 1-866-OURVOTE. And we will obviously do everything in our power to make sure that those jurisdictions don't implement those racially discriminatory laws. And that's precisely what the Justice Department needs to do. It needs to double up its attorneys, get ready to use Section 2 of the law, which is the, which allows you to sue after the bad deed has been done, which is the tragedy, because what was beautiful about Section 5 and Section 4 was that it made people stop discriminating before they could. It stopped them before they could discriminate. This, now we got to sue after people have discriminated. But we need to know what people are doing. And any place where we see people trying to institute a bad law, what we need to be doing is bringing some injunctive actions to stop them from doing so. We also need to be looking at habitually bad jurisdictions and using Section 3 of the law. Section 3 allows for what's called a bail-in procedure. For jurisdictions, courts can actually bail in jurisdictions to make them covered by Section 5 if, in fact, they continually violate the law by passing racially discriminatory and ethnically discriminatory procedures and practices.
Well, that's very good. And have you written that up yet?
I'm happy to, you know.
No,
write,
I think that's very important because we could put it up on the site. It's very important about Section 2. See, I didn't know that. So that's two very good examples. And then let me go back to, of course, so many problems. The first is that the right wing is so systematic, so brilliant about, it's like 40 years ago they planned a counter-revolution and they've just done it in 4,000 acts. And one of them has been to gut the staff of any regulatory agency so that, you know, I'm sure that even in the sequestration, there were cuts in the Justice Department's enforcement budget. Is that right?
Yes, and one thing definitely, and one thing Justice is doing is, you know, is definitely reshuffling staff to, you know, to deal with this, you know, court ruling. And you know, Eric, to your earlier point, if you're in law school right now and you're asking that question that you asked earlier about what do you do when you know you got an ideologically leaning court that's not going to listen to facts, that's not going to make a decision based on law, that ignores the whole 15th Amendment and making a decision, creates new standards out of whole cloth or out of air, you know, it is important for everyone to remember that those of us who believe and love justice, we have to continue in this fight because the scales of justice do tilt and they don't always stay in the favor of, you know, injustice, that in fact they will balance out if we do our part. So one day, there will be an opportunity to appoint another justice to the court. With a one justice, you know, change, we will in fact have the ability to have a whole different kind of Supreme Court that's much more fair. And what I want everyone to understand is that means then that our duty right now is to make sure that we're doing everything we can to vote when we have the opportunity, and everybody who is hearing me should have one concept in their mind. 2014, I vote, because whoever's in the Senate will be deciding who's going to be on the court, who's ever, you know, and you need Congress people who can pass, you know, good laws to redress this, because we cannot sit back and just say, well, the Supreme Court, this five-person dictatorship, you know, has done this injustice to us, and we're somehow shackled with it. We got to fight back. And I'm here to tell people that we're saying to the entire nation, rise up for justice. Rise up for justice. And, you know, and get involved. You know, demand congressional action. They will respond if you demand it. Demand, you know, demonstrate, pray in, speak out, you know, monitor and report, educate, you know, demand, you know, election reform. In your state, you know, there's a whole lot of things. Be part of the March on Washington on August the 24th. You know, come here and make it heard because we're going to turn this into a voting rights march and do everything in your power to resist in the fight back because we need to rise up for justice and not allow this court to get away with this.
Barbara, I'm going to let you get that last word. I want to just tell you a couple of thoughts before you go of my last word. This is still a draft of an article that I'm writing, and it says, it begins, every law school in the United States should hold out a sign. The Supreme Court does not abide by any laws or precedents. It is intent on reestablishing slavery in all its forms. I will make up the laws as it goes along to achieve those objectives. Law students and juries should practice nullification because the only law of the land is racism and segregation. Now, I do think, and I want to say this is a very serious organizing project, that law students need to challenge their own law schools to speak out against this level of not just judicial social engineering, but literally re-enslavement, and have to delegitimize the Roberts Court. We need more and more deans of law schools to say, hey, look, there's conservatives and there's liberals, but you guys are basically liars. you're just making it up out of whole cloth. And during the 60s, we pressured people who did not want to take a stand at first against the president, a Democratic president, or didn't want to take a stand on, you know, on taking on the Supreme Court. But I don't think that law students can just keep going in and saying, well, yeah, that's bad and that's bad, but I'm still going to just work really hard, without in some way working to delegitimize the very laws that they're going to try to study and change. Because as you read these legal decisions, they're crazy. They're just insane. Look, I mean, sometimes a conservative can make a good argument, but under the Sandoval decision, for instance, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that Congress had never intended for private parties like the Labor Community Strategy Center and the Bus Riders Union to bring civil rights suits under Title VI. And Brennan, I believe, who wrote this ferocious dissent, said, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard. The law was passed in 1964. This is 2001. There's been thousands and thousands of Title VI cases. In 2001, you decide that Congress never intended for people to do this. You just have 5 votes. That's all you have. And you're making up the law as you go along. And the same thing has happened now, whereas, as you said, there's no legal basis for this. So my question is, Barbara, that, and I'm serious, it may not be the tactical plan for Lawyers Committee, you know, but I, as an organizer too, think that we have to challenge the law schools to say, you have to speak out on this. You have to speak out on the fraudulent of nature now, of anti-civil rights, of racist laws that are being passed. And you can't just tell people, go back into those courts and work harder.
In fact, I think it's very important for people to understand where you're coming from. I encourage everyone to look up Richard Posner, P-O-S-N-E-R, who is a judge on the Seventh Circuit, and he wrote, after the decision in Shelby, he wrote a scathing, as a sitting judge now, he is a sitting judge of the Seventh Circuit, and he wrote a scathing, absolutely angry article talking about how this court had turned its back on justice. And it is important for the legal profession to demand that the court, abide by the rule of law and not, you know, operate in this kind of ideological way, and to give this nation, you know, do such a disservice to this nation by, you know, talking about current conditions and ignoring, absolutely not saying one word about the voter suppression that's been taking place in this country dramatically for the last 2 years and constantly for the last, you know, 13. So it's very, very important for what you're talking about to be true, that lawyers have to hold the court accountable. And I was very proud of Judge Posner for not sitting back and for speaking out as a sitting judge and saying this is a discredit on the court.
That's a great reference, Barbara. Say his name again.
Judge Richard Posner, P-O-S-N-E-R.
All right, we're going to get that decision. Listen to our listeners. We're going to get that decision. We're going to get his article. We're going to read some of it on the air. We're even going to see if we'll come on the show next week, because we stay on these issues. We don't just move. Well, that was interesting about voting rights. We have stayed with Mumia. We have stayed on voting rights. We've stayed on Title VI. And Barbara, I guess you and I, we just keep staying, huh?
Right. Listen, the reason why this country is, you know, not totally insane is because people like us fight for sanity. We fight for what we know should be the real America, an America that is, you know, racially just, an America that is gender, you know, equal, America that gives respect and dignity to all people, that has economic justice and environmental justice. I mean, we understand that we have to fight for these things because they are within our reach as a nation, but they are only going to be within our reach if we fight.
Well, Barbara, here's my last word. The voice of Barbara Arnwine, the President and Executive Director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. And I'll end by saying this, Barbara. I was in D.C. and talking to some sort of moderates around the Justice Department, and they paid you the greatest compliment. They said, she's too militant and she's too black. She's too militant and she's too black. Black, black, black. All she wants to talk about is race. I said, well, excuse me, that's what else is she supposed to talk about? So, Barbara, congratulations. Nobody's saying, you know, nobody is, you have not lost any fire. You still got the focus. Let's stay in touch, Barbara.
Thank you.
All right, great having you on the show.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye. Very happy to be on the phone now with Brent and Mark. Hi, Brent. How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure. Just to tell folks, Brent is, he's in New Orleans right now to continue the discussion of the Voting Rights Act. We just had Barbara Arnwine on, Brent, who is, you know, did a really good job of running down the actual court case.
And, absolutely.
And Brent and Mark is a New Orleans-based journalist who serves as Colorline Magazine's reporting fellow on voting rights, covering the challenges presented by new voter ID laws, suppression of voter registration drives, and other attempts to limit electoral power of people of color. Also, I'll say, as somebody who's a reader of Colorlines, I've been really depending, Brent, on a lot of your articles for really being some of the best out there. Very, very helpful. I urge people to go to www.colorlines.com, right?
Yes.
And just click on voting rights, although a lot of his articles are already on the front page. So great to have you on the show. This show, Brent, just to tell you, is that the listenership that we have are mainly people that want to do something. You know, this is a audience that generally knows what's right and wrong, but we're trying to figure out strategy, tactics, what do we do? So I want to ask you a couple of questions. Let's move on to the question of congressional possibility. Obviously, we understand, I was saying to Barbara, that under the Sandoval case in 2001, the Supreme Court took away the right of private parties to bring civil rights suit and said, well, if Congress wants to change it, it can change it. And, of course, Congress will not touch it. Now it's saying, well, if Congress wants to reinvestigate the actually discriminatory parties, it can do so and reestablish a set of criteria and reestablish a set of specific locations. But in the midst of all the things we just said about you, new voter ID laws, suppression of voter registration drives, other attempts to limit electoral power of people of color, why do we have any reason to believe that Congress wants to re-strengthen this law?
I think that there's definitely low confidence that the Congress in total would have the political will to pass a new Voting Rights Act coverage formula, especially amidst the other legislative priorities that they have on their plate, and not to mention the fact that this is the 113th Congress is literally the most do-nothing Congress in the history of America since we started keeping track. So the fact, you know, the idea that they might do something on this, you know, I don't think a lot of people are holding their breath. At the same time, I think I have to remain encouraged as an African American who's definitely impacted by that decision from the Supreme Court. I have to be encouraged by the work of people like Barbara Arnwine and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, other groups like NAACP and the Advancement Project, people who really pulled off some nothing short of miracles last year as they fought off purging laws, voter ID laws, proof of citizenship laws, laws that would cut early voting. I mean, the cynic in me really thought that a lot of those laws were going to end up passing, and a lot of these groups ended up fighting them off. So I have no reason, I have little other option but to be optimistic that something can happen in Congress or elsewhere.
Well, I do too, and just to be clear, that my views is that there's two areas that I'm interested in looking at. One is to single out President Obama and Attorney General Holder and say, let's not hide behind what the Republican 5-4 vote was. You have more federal authority. You have the ability to be very aggressive. If you can't pre-investigate, as Barb was saying, you can be watching them the second that they make their move. Secondly, the president has the capacity to withhold federal funds, not on the basis of voting rights violations, but on other violations of civil rights, and could be much more aggressive under that. And the second thing is that I was in the civil rights movement when we didn't have a Civil Rights Act. I was in the civil rights movement when we didn't have a Voting Rights Act. We won the Civil Rights Act. We won the Voting Rights Act. And I think a lot of people, and I think it's going to happen, that there's going to be large-scale civil disobedience, I hope, and large-scale fighting these things right on the ground, as well as the legal challenges that you talked about.
I think that the will is definitely definitely with the people. I know that Attorney General Eric Holder has definitely pledged to sic his staff and his attorneys on all of the jurisdictions to make sure that they enforce all of the other sections of the Voting Rights Act as well as the Civil Rights Act. And, you know, today was the 49th anniversary of the passing of the Civil Rights Act. So I think that the will is there in the Obama administration and even with the people. Probably it's going to really hit hard, I think, when a lot of these kind of more localized election changes start to take root. Like right now, this is still a really abstract thing for us. I mean, the Supreme Court made its decision, and we know that it was a devastating blow. But a lot of people are still thinking that this is just about voter ID laws and these other kind of statewide measures. The pain is really going to be felt at the local level, and that's when I think people are going to really start going into civil disobedience. It'll be when during your mayoral election or your city council election, someone moves a polling location from a place that was very accessible to elderly, low-income African Americans, maybe in a senior home, and then they end up moving it way out to some exclusive white country club way out in the suburbs. I mean, these are the kinds of things that were captured and prevented by the Voting Rights Act. And it goes under the radar, right? Because those things don't make the headlines the way that voter ID laws make the headlines. So when those things start to happen, I think you're going to really start to see some unrest.
Well, the voice you're listening to is Brenton Mock. He's a writer for CarLines.com. It's a daily newspaper, an online civil rights, people of color, based on W.E.B. Du Bois's observation that the central question of the 20th century will be the color line. Du Bois probably figured out before he died that that would be the central question of the 21st century as well. So one of the things I was going to ask you is that in a lot of the Black South, building on your point about local elections, as almost all the whites have gone Republican, in most southern states, the Black vote at the national level or even at the Senate level has been radically weakened because it's just been the whites vote Republican. But what I was realizing is in many, many communities where Black people are the majority, there's been, like Barbara Arnoy was saying, a tremendous expansion of Black, Latino, Indigenous, Asian people getting elected to be mayors and sheriffs. And so that is going to be a very significant area of fight. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. I mean, the fight is really going to be at the local level. I mean, when you think about what led up to the passing of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, a lot of that was local fights. I mean, as you said, you lived through it, so I'm sure you know. I mean, those original fights were with county and city local registrars, right? The people who were standing in the way of registering of African Americans who were trying to register themselves to vote throughout the 40s and 50s and the early 60s. And then you found right after the Voting Rights Act that a lot of these states, including Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama, they started going into kind of more, sneaky, shady ways of purging people off of the voting rolls. And again, these were local county registrars. And when you look at that, so in Louisiana, right after the Voting Rights Act, something like 50,000 African Americans were purged from the voting rolls for really questionable reasons. Now, when you look at that, and you look at what happened in Florida last year, where the state came up with a list of something roughly 3,000 names that were at risk of being purged from the list. You see that there's not really a big difference between what happened in 1965 and what happened in 2012. And these are the kinds of things that we have to pay attention to. It's what's happening at the local level.
Well, I think one of the things as an organizer that we're all trying to figure out is what's it going to take to spark a much higher level of protest, a much more protracted level. It's not, as somebody who's been doing this most of my life, it's not just going to be reconstructed easily. There's a lot of very, very difficult factors right now. But I think one of the things that's very interesting is that when, in fact, the civil rights movement was focusing on public accommodations, was focusing on more militant confrontations with employers, with government agencies, Kennedy brought the civil rights leaders in and said, I think you guys should focus on voting. One, parenthesis, because if you want to have more power, if I'm going to take on the white South, I'm going to need Black votes. And two, I wish you wouldn't in some way take on some of those other targets because it's really, you know, getting the white folks up in arms. So there was a big struggle about that where SNCC did not agree to that and CORE did not agree to that, but some of the other forces in the civil rights movement were convinced that that was a good tactic. And then, as Malcolm X talks about in one of his speeches, foundations came in and started saying to a civil rights group, if you want to do voter registration, we got money for you. If you want to do sit-ins and takeovers, we don't have any money. Now, leaving aside what should have been done, because I certainly think all of those should have been done, but my point was to just say that voting rights was offered to the civil rights movement as its silver bullet, right? As the key, and some people bought into it. Now, the Voting Rights Act was a phenomenal victory, as was the Civil Rights Act. It has enfranchised large numbers of people. But as you pointed out, the day was passed. They began to move towards disenfranchisement. So I think today the question is the civil rights movement going to make the fight over the vote a frontline fight?
I think that's a good question. And I don't want to speculate one way or the other about what the leading civil rights groups are doing. I mean, I know that the NAACP, the Advancement Project, the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights, I know that they are fired up. I know that they are gearing up for even more fights. I just did a story today about there was a teleconference where not only the traditional civil rights groups came together, but they also brought in environmental groups, immigration reform and Latino rights groups, gay and lesbian rights groups. They all came together, Sierra Club, Greenpeace, NCLR, National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, all of these organizations came together and they pledged, a full blitz on anyone who was trying to take away the voting rights of Americans. And it definitely was encouraging to see all of those groups come together. I think we shouldn't just leave it just to the premier civil rights groups to have this fight. I mean, right after, not even a few days after the Supreme Court decision came down, BET had a music awards show, and I don't think there was one mention at all about the voting rights. There was in my Twitter timeline, not on my Facebook updates. I didn't hear any mention of this at all. And given that African Americans really got the short end of the stick in terms of all of those Supreme Court decisions last week, I mean, you would really expect someone like BET to really up their game and hopefully take, you know, opportunity when they have such a large audience captive to make some kind of pledge or say something about this. This week there's an Essence Fest right here in New Orleans. I know that I see that Al Sharpton, Congressman John Lewis, you know, Most Honorable Merle Ever Williams, they're all going to be here for that, speaking, and I trust that they're going to be speaking about, what needs to come next in terms of the Voting Rights Act. But it's ultimately going to be up to us. It's going to be up to the people at Essence Fest and, African Americans in general to start reprioritizing in their own lives, you know, what it is that they need to do to ensure that they have fair and free and equal access to democracy. And right now, if we take that for granted, we're gonna feel a lot of pain in the coming years.
Again, totally agree with you. That's Brenton Mock from Carlines and several other magazines. You know, Brent, one of the things, again, I've been thinking about because I've just been doing a lot of thinking is, well, I'm happy to say that my own organization, the Labor Community Strategy Center, we have a new campaign called the Fight for the Soul of the Cities. And this campaign is talking about freeing the U.S. 2.5 million prisoners. It's talking about open borders and amnesty for immigrants, an end to U.S. drone attacks. It's calling for no fare in Los Angeles and 5,000 new zero-emission buses. It's calling for no cars in L.A. And one of the conversations that we've been having is, are we going to start being more disruptive again? Because let me just give you an example. When Mayor Villaraigosa, who he had many struggles with, was getting an award. This is about the Essence magazine, and this is about the awards. This is where I'm going, okay, Brenton, so you know where this is going. Mayor Villaraigosa was going to get this award about 8 years ago, a member of the assembly, from the People's College of Law. And we love the People's College of Law. It's a great people's law school. But we didn't want the mayor to get this award unchallenged. So Mari Aguirre, who is a domestic worker and a member of the bus riders union, she organized this campaign to challenge the mayor. And our members called up all the other people who are getting the awards to say, look, we feel really bad. This is going to turn out to be a love fest for the mayor. Then we called up our friends at the People's College of Law and said, look, we don't want to mess up your thing. We got to find some balance here. But we don't want this to go unchallenged. And we negotiated something pretty good. We put leaflets out on people's table. We didn't disrupt from the floor. And to everybody's shock, the guy right before the mayor who got the award said, "Mr. Mayor, I'm really ashamed of what you've done in terms of cutting bus service. You got to do a lot better than that." And he was livid because they ruined his party. And I think that ruining the party, ruining white people's party in particular, but going into structures, schools and hospitals and churches and being more ideologically disruptive is going to be a very important new arena of struggle.
And I mean, again, I think nothing should be taken off the table. I mean, this is a quite important, this is probably the most important legislation covered the lives of African Americans and protected, the rights of democracy, for African Americans. And, you know, when you look back at, again, going back to the creation of the Voting Rights Act, you had groups like, the NAACP who, they wanted to fight this out in the court, not in the street. And then you had presidents like John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson who really weren't, they weren't happy about what, Martin Luther King and what SCLC and other organizations were doing when they were holding marches and when they were holding sit-ins and having other kinds of, public demonstrations. They preferred to have this done behind closed doors, quietly, in legislative chambers, in court chambers. And quite frankly, a lot of civil rights groups or a lot of civil rights figures weren't happy with what Martin Luther King and a lot of the street demonstrators were doing back then in the early 60s as well. But I think looking back now, I think we can see that the victories that happened in court and in the legislative chambers probably would not have happened if not for the publicizing and the TV broadcasting of what happened on Bloody Sunday and seeing black people chewed up by dogs and fire hose, seeing people getting beaten while they were doing nothing but kneeling down and praying. And also I think it just, if we take it to today, the most influential court is the court of public opinion. If there were no other evidence, as we see with social media right now, I mean, a lot of changes have been made because people publicly shared information by Twitter, by Facebook, and that's why so many people know about what's going on with Trayvon Martin right now. That's why so many people know what happened with Arab Spring. And so, it can't just be a thing of just relying on Congress, especially not this Congress. And again, we can't just lay everything on the hook of the civil rights lawyers, whether that's the civil rights lawyers at NAACP or the civil rights lawyers that are with the Department of Justice. I think the people in general, they are going to have to get angry. They're going to have to get out there, have their voice heard, and they may have to, they may have to do some civil unrest.
Well, the voice you're listening to is Benton Mock. In your last minute and a half, how'd you get involved in this right this second? Because you're doing great work. You are working on social media. You're doing stuff. What makes you fight in the morning?
My son. I have a 10-year-old son. His name is Justice. And I really want to leave a world that's much more rooted in equality and justice than the one that I lived in for him. I don't want it to be a worse world for him or worse society for him. So I would have to say my son.
Well, I think that's a really wonderful answer. And Brenton, stay in touch. I think I did an article on Trayvon Martin on Color Lines. And say hello to Rinku and Kai and all the other great people at Color Lines. And keep up your important work right now. People at the Strategy Center are reading your stuff regularly. You can could read Brenton Mock's pretty much daily, write commentaries on the present set of situations at www.colorlines.com. Brenton, thanks so much for being on the show, and we'll try to do it again.
Okay, thanks again for having me on.
Okay, take care.
Okay.
The pieces are coming together for some kind of a significant pushback, and Voices from the Front Lines is trying to contribute in any small way we can to rebuilding the left and rebuilding some kind of a revolutionary response in the United States. So with that does it for today's Voices show. As always, thanks for listening to Voices from the Front Lines. This has been your host, Eric Mann. I'd like to thank our guests, Barbara Arnwine and Brenton Mock.